What does it mean to speak a language? When does a language belong to you? Do you go to a language, or do you make the language come to you? On this episode, we'll talk about these questions and more with a now prize-winning translator. I'm Dominic Boyle, and this is the Asymptote Podcast. But first, you may have noticed that we have a brand new issue up, and what an issue it is. In it, we announce this year's winners of Asymptote's International Translation Contest, Close Approximations, with literature representing 27 countries, translated from 21 different languages. This is not an issue to miss. Check it out at asymptotejournal.com. Also, if you like what we do, online and in audio, the best way to support Asymptote is to become a sustaining member. For as little as $5 a month, you can help us continue to unlock the literary treasures of the world and enjoy some great perks. Become a sustaining member at asymptotejournal.com/donate. But don't stop listening, because in this episode, I interview the translator who won the Asymptote Close Approximations Fiction Prize for 2017, Suchitra Ramachandran. Her prize-winning entry is a delicate and evocative translation of Periyama's words, a short story by the great Tamil writer Jayamohan. Set in a small town in rural India, the story revolves around two characters, a young, unnamed narrator who is sliding by in life when he is enlisted to teach English to Periyama, an aging matriarch and town icon. As he quickly discovers, what he thought would be a simple job teaching an old woman some words soon turns into anything but, as the narrator and Periyama get pulled together in a tangled net of semiosis. Periyama, it turns out, doesn't just want words, she demands concepts. With a yarn of epic stories from India and the West, together they knit a new world which lives in the language of Periyama, one which she can take with her as she leaves India to live with her last remaining family member in the United States. The story is rich with the symbolic layering and nostalgia which characterizes Jayamohan's writing, and its linguistic somersaults make the translation a joy to read. You can read the whole story under the feature tab on our website. I sat down with Ramachandran in Basel, Switzerland to talk about her work. So, can you talk a little bit about your background? Growing up, what was your relationship with language like?
So I grew up in India all through. And the thing with being in India is, and I think this, I speak for a lot of Indians when I say this, we grew up in touch with a lot of different languages. You might see a family, for example, where, you know, the father speaks one language and the mother side of the family speaks a completely different language, and it's all very organic. So the kids grew up knowing, you know, both of these languages. And that was sort of my background too. And additionally, we moved around a lot. I've lived in 4 or 5 different states in India, each of which has a very different cultural and linguistic background.
So how many different languages did you have exposure to?
Oh, that's a great question. So my mother tongue is Tamil, which my parents spoke, but at home. But incidentally, like, my mother teaches English to school children. So I grew up learning English almost as a co-mother tongue. In addition, I can read, write, and understand Hindi well, speak not so well. But I can also understand Telugu and Malayalam. I think it's true that for most Indians, the linguistic barrier between two Indian languages is not very large. So you can actually transcend that pretty quickly if you're motivated enough to learn a language. I also had exposure to Sanskrit. So knowing two classical languages, in my case, Tamil and Sanskrit, I think has really, I think that sort of was the foundation of my interest in translation.
It provided a fruitful bed, you could say, to build your other linguistic skills on.
I think that is true. I think I would say that. And when I say exposure, it's not even a course of study in school and so on, but it's a very organic exposure to both of these classical languages in my day-to-day life. I think that was what paved the way for this.
So how did you start translating?
Most of the literature that I studied growing up was in English, and it was European world literature, nothing tremendously Indian. Then when I went to grad school, I was in Pittsburgh, and I started getting interested in Indian literature. And of course, the first Indian literature that I picked up was Indian writing in English. And honestly, I found it insufficient. I found it a bit boring, and it didn't really cater to my interests or the questions that I had. And then I started picking up, you know, translations, English translations of works that were Indian in origin, but, you know, had been translated into English. And then I found myself making my way back to my roots, back to Tamil and Kannada and Bengali and all these other languages. Then I realized that there was a wealth of literature in my own mother tongue, in my own backyard, that I had not read for all those years. And I started, you know, voraciously reading it. And one way to get in touch with a language, to really, you know, learn the nuances of a language, is to translate to it and from it. And when I started reading classical Tamil, I found it very useful for me, particularly to dabble in translation. And I guess that's how my journey with translation started. And the more I read modern Tamil literature, it seems to me that it's extremely important that it needs to find a wider audience. It needs to, you know, I think more people in the world would be interested in it if only it was made available to a wider audience. So I think that is why I became a translator, because I think the language has a wealth of literature that needs to enter the world's arena.
Is that quite common in India, that you would go to school and read works from the Western canon in English instead of Indian literature?
I would say that's true. For example, in a typical English classroom, when you're 14 to 17, you'd read Shakespeare. But you would also read, you know, say a short story by Mulk Raj Anand or Rabindranath Tagore, who are our literary greats. But again, those would be English translations, and they were sort of always on the margins. When you say English literature, it was always assumed that you were talking about Shakespeare or Milton, for example. A lot of people who study even up to, you know, MA or a PhD in Tamil might not be familiar with the rudiments of Tamil literature, modern Tamil literature.
So a background like the narrator has in Priyama's words is actually quite typical.
Oh, yes. The narrator in the story is actually very, very typical, I would say, of your average Indian young man or young woman.
But at the same time, he's not as normal as he seems at first.
The narrator is a very interesting person if you really pay attention to his characterization. He has a sensitivity and a sensibility that is atypical of the average young person anywhere in the world, I would think. So that marks him out as special. Only he could, you know, have the brainwave to teach Priyama language in that sort of a way where, you know, he trades stories with her. Plus, he doesn't want to move out of his hometown for whatever reason. Whereas Priyama needs to do it at her elderly age. But this person, you know, there's an existence for this character outside of the story. And the way I imagine him is, after the story is over, I think he would still continue to live on in his hometown. He would probably marry someone in his hometown. He would stay there and he would be an English teacher in his school or something. And he would die there probably. And so that sort of a rootedness encapsulates the narrator for me. And when you start seeing the story through those lines, it brings the character more alive, I think.
And what about Periyamma?
The Periyamma, on the other hand, Periyamma is not just an old woman. She is a symbol of a particular time in the past. You know, she's a matriarch. She's a very strong character. You know, the way she orders around her servants or the young man who is her teacher. But if you read the story well enough, it's clear that the strength and the will that she represents are not of her own personality. It's not about a single woman called Periyamma, but, you know, there is this whole system of foremothers before her whose spirit she's channeling. The society in Kerala about 70, 80 years ago was a matrilineal society, and they were characterized by a sort of a fierceness and strength. And it is that strength that Periyamma embodies. And it is that strength, I think, that she takes with her, even when she moves out of her country, when she moves out of her land, when she is wrested out of her land, she still holds on to her selfhood. And I think that is what comes out at the end, you know, when she puts her hand on her chest and she says, "Myself." It's her being that she has discovered through the journey of learning English.
To me, it seems like, you know, although the narrator is trying to teach Priyamma English, in reality, at the end, they really create their own language. They decide on their own concepts and their own contexts, which the words point to.
So I think you touched on a very important point. It's not that Priyamma gains strength from learning English, and I think that's a very, very fine point to make. She gains strength from learning a language that is her own. She literally makes a language that she makes her own. See, when Priyamma learns English, the questions she asks are not, you know, tell me the English word for so and so. It's almost like, in my life, I think about Arul. I think about Madulam Palam, or, you know, the word for pomegranate. So she looks around her and she says, this is my world. So tell me, what is the words? How do you say all these things in English? She wants the language to represent her world. And it created that weirdly beautiful language that Periyamma ended up creating.
The other thing that happens is that she kind of insists, or that she asks for, a collapsing of meaning in some ways. She says, you know, I don't want to learn all these words. Just give me one word that does all of these things. And it's really like she does not let the language tell her what to do. She's quite demanding on the language itself.
She's very particular about what the language should do for her. You know, she sits like a reigning matriarch and she's like, okay, language, you come to me and, you know, I will make you do what I want you to do. And I think that's her defining spirit. I mean, and this woman is the kind of woman who can make the world her town because she knows who she is. And that's a very powerful idea, I think.
In some ways, it's like she refuses to accept one of the central problems of translation, that there is not a one-to-one correspondence between things in different languages. She says, no, give me a word that says this or that does all of this.
Yes, that is true. I think what they end up doing is they create a new world. I think there's a story that I can tell that might help to understand this, right? And incidentally, there was an article in Asymptote about it, which I read a couple of weeks ago, the story of Trishanku. So there was a king called Trishanku. Okay, and he was a very noble king, and when he died, he wanted to go to heaven, but he was very ambitious and he said, I want to go to heaven with my body. And the gatekeepers of heaven said, no, you can't do that, because only the soul or the spirit can go to heaven. And you know, he kept wanting to go, and he kept going around and asking people to help him, and finally a wise sage said, okay, I will help you. And he used all of his power to lift this guy bodily and put him into heaven. But the gatekeepers of heaven kept pushing him out because they said, I don't want your body. So eventually what they had to do was to create a heaven for this fellow and call it Trishanku's heaven. And so that exists as a third world, not the earth, not heaven, but as a third world. And so I think what happens in translation is very similar. You know, it's not about translation. It's not about taking something from somewhere to somewhere. But it's about creating a third world, a new holding vessel for this very nebulous concept that is there in that source story. And it's not even about taking it to a target language, but it's to fashion a new language that is somewhere between the source and target languages that can hold this in.
As compact as this piece is, it's full of metatextual and metalinguistic dialogue. What was it like wrangling with such a multifaceted text as a translator?
I think it was tremendous fun. I picked this story for translation because when I read it for the first time when it was published in 2015. And, you know, I realized that it's both a translator's dream and nightmare immediately because it layers so many things and so many concepts and so many symbols one over the other. And, you know, there's also an inside joke in translating the story because, you know, while the narrator is teaching Periyamma English within the story, in the act of translation, I'm trying to teach the readers of the story, I mean, the people who read this story in English, I'm trying to teach them Tamil.
Ramachandran said that this playfulness with language and cross-linguistic self-referencing also made translation more challenging.
But it was very challenging because, you know, I had to make a lot of stylistic changes, stylistic decisions to, you know, to make sure that the spirit of the story was properly transmitted into English without the flow necessarily being broken, because there the story hinges on a lot of little stories from the epics that convey the concepts that the narrator uses to teach Periyamma.
What audience did you have in mind when you were translating this piece?
I think there are really three audiences to the story. I think then it became necessary to actually, when I did the translation, to process these three kinds of audiences who would all read the translation. A person who knows Tamil, so who can maybe understand some of the inside jokes and the layers in the story that only a Tamil speaker can understand. An Indian reader who necessarily doesn't know Tamil, and a foreign reader who has, you know, no familiarity with either the language or the symbols or the epics that underlie these worlds. So it was important to keep all three kinds of readers in mind.
But it strikes me that for both audiences, one of the stories is familiar and the other is foreign, but maybe it's inverted. So, you know, did you change a lot? Did you have to add a lot of that context, or what was that like, the balance?
That's a great question. Surprisingly, though, the original in Tamil doesn't, you know, go into a whole lot of detail about Ulysses or Helen of Troy. What's there in the translation, those lines about Helen of Troy or Ulysses, is exactly what is there in the original. So the I think that's the that's the craft of writing that you can see there. And I think what it conveys is really the thrust of the incident itself. For example, the story of Helen of Troy to a Tamil reader, especially from someone from who's old guard, who's conservative, might be like, that's really unfaithful of the wife. Why would she do that? But I think that's precisely what the author wants to evoke in the reader's mind. And I think that's the craft of the writing. So it's really compressed. Whereas when I did the translation, I had to give the reader some context. There are lots of places in the text that I have subtly included a little bit of context here and there. There's a story that Periyamma narrates about a character in the Mahabharata called Daruman. The Mahabharata is a grand epic with five brothers, and the eldest of the five brothers in the story is Daruman, and his father was the god of justice, also called Dharmadevan. So, they all have very similar names. And to a reader in Tamil, you just get it immediately. You know that, there's a history to Daruman and his father Dharmadevan and all of these characters. But to a foreign reader, I really have to, make it clear who is Daruman and who is Dharmadevan and why they have such similar but slightly different names and all of these ideas. So that was challenging, but that was, I think, the most fun part.
In the past, you've translated Tamil love poems from the 3rd BCE. Then, after you translated these poems, you would make digital illustrations and post them on social media and Twitter. I'm wondering what it was like to see the immediate reaction of people to your work. I mean, that kind of immediacy and dialogue is not something that most translators get access to.
So I think I started that for fun more than anything else, because when it came to Tamil and when I started to read Tamil, I think I went about it in a very clinical way, sort of, I'm going to, conquer every dragon that comes my way. And classical Tamil is really hard. So I would actually sit down, I'd make time for it every morning, and then I would like study. And one of the things that helped me to enjoy them as poems was to actually draw out the central image that each of these poems evoke. And they evoke such beautiful images. You might have heard of Red Earth and Pouring Rain. That's very common. I think I enjoyed drawing them because, it was fun. And somehow the poem came alive for me when I did that. And then I started sharing them on social media just to, show people, hey, this can be done. And I was surprised, honestly, that there was a lot of reception for it, because I think on some level, a lot of Indians really want to learn, get back to classical literature and learn the classics. But there's always this mental barrier. You think it's too hard, or you think it's too sophisticated. But you make it accessible, I think it really works. And I think that there are a lot of projects like that are currently running, where people are really trying to translate and make these old poems accessible to a modern reader, to a non-Indian reader. One of the best parts about that whole project was when I started receiving emails from other Indians who don't know Tamil, who can't read Tamil, who said, I had no idea that Tamil had such beautiful poetry in it. It was very heartening that that even within the same country, you're able to reach across to a person from a different background and make them, love your own literature. I think that was very, very rewarding.
And I think that's clearly what you've done with this translation of Periyamma's words as well. From what we've been talking about so far, it seems to me that you really have a positive look for Periyamma's future in the U.S. I mean, personally, when I was reading the story, I started to get worried. I was nervous. I felt like, she's going into who knows what, and her future to me was really uncertain. So it's good that you have a positive outlook instead.
At that point, it becomes the reader's reading, right? And the reason I take a positive outlook is I think Periyamma has, like I said, reconfirmed for herself who she is and who her identity is and what she is. And it's been my experience that once you know what you represent and who you come from, what your tradition is and what your values are, That gives you a very strong grounding. And I know that Periyamma doesn't have a lot of time left on the earth. I know I'm talking about her like she's a real person somewhere there, but I think after a point, the characters become real to you. But the reason I'm so positive about her is I think the journey that the story takes her through has given her the weapons to fight against those sort of that's sort of the existential crisis that she would find herself in when she's removed from her land. So I think that's important.
Well, thanks very much for talking to me today. And congratulations on winning the first prize in fiction for the 2017 Close Approximations Translation Contest.
Thank you very much for doing the interview. I'm very happy. My name is Suchitra Ramachandran. I am from Madurai, a town in the state of Tamil Nadu in India. I am a translator and I translate primarily from Tamil to English, although I also translate the other way around. I am currently working as a researcher in Basel, in Switzerland.
That's it for this week's episode of the Asymptote Podcast. And remember, you can check out the entire new summer issue out now online at asymptotejournal.com. I'm Dominic Boyle. Thanks for listening.